Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome once again to another fantastic episode of the Business Creators Radio Show. My name is Adam Homey. I am your host, and I am honored by your wise decision to tune in and join us today. We are business creators. We are entrepreneurs, small business owners, local business owners. We're marketing and business coaches, consultants, and mentors. We are the business creators who help others grow their businesses, and we also have the do-it-yourselfers who like to have your own hands on the levers as you market and grow. If you are one or more of the above, and in fact, many of our listeners who tune in every week are all of the above, please take a moment, explore episodes, discover how we help you win at the game of business and marketing at www.businesscreatorsradioshow.com. Also, be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes. Every 5-star rating is greatly appreciated and helps us help more business creators just like you. And when you subscribe to us in iTunes at Business Creators Radio Show, over 190 episodes, as of this writing, will be available for your immediate perusal on a broad variety of topics related to business creators. Now, speaking of topics, what we're going to talk about today is something that crossed my desk a few weeks ago that when I first saw it, I thought was very, very interesting. It's the idea of not letting the 80-20 principle mislead you. Now, many of our listeners know what the 80-20 principle is. It's the idea that you'll get 80% of your results from 20% of your effort or 20% of your work. It can also apply to getting 80% of the productivity from 20% of your people, 80% of your return from 20% of your investment. It's just the whole idea of the 80-20. Now, we're taught that in middle school, we're taught it in high school, we're taught it in college, we're taught it in business school, we're taught it in MBA programs, we're taught it in every entrepreneurial program that's out there, but it can be misleading, and we're going to talk about that in just a few minutes. And to help us understand that, I am happy to introduce you to a gentleman who I've had a great amount of joy getting to know here in the past few minutes, John Bassian. John, welcome aboard.
Hi, Adam. Thanks for having me on your show.
Thank you for being here. The honor is all mine. So first of all, let's tell the audience about John. John Bassian is the author of 8 books about rational living, including When Everything Fails, Try This, Rationality is the Way to Happiness, The Philosophy of Builders, How to Build a Great Future with the Pieces from Your Past, The 10 Principles of Rational Living, Rational Living, Rational Working, How to Make Winning Moves When Things Are Falling Apart, Consistency, The Key to Permanent Stress Relief, On Becoming Unbreakable, How Normal People Become Extraordinarily Self-Confident, and Thriving in Difficult Times, 12 Lessons from Ancient Greece to Improve Your Life Today, which is John's most recent book. So as we can see, John is very prolific, and he has shared a lot on the idea of rationality and growing your business and how do you become resilient and strong. But what I'd like to do now, before we dive into the subject matter here, is for those of you who are listening who are just getting a chance to know John, here's my first question for you, John. I read off and your list of books, and that's all very impressive and everything else. What we'd like you to do is just tell us a little bit more in your own words about your own personal journey or your business journey that has led you to where we are now and how you serve business creators from the intersection of your brilliance and passion. So in other words, a little bit about your personal story and how you arrived here.
Yes, I have developed a commercial career for many years, for decades. For decades, I've been a voracious reader of sales books, business books, psychology books, personal development, philosophy. And at a certain point, and we are talking 2007, 2008, I grew very unhappy, very dissatisfied with the kind of books I was reading, because I found them, most of them, very superficial, contradictory, vague, not really based on fact. They're based on little stories, usually personal stories of the author, but they're not really applicable to the public, to the reader. So I started to write the kind of books I want to read. And these are books about personal development, very much based on logic, based on history, and based on reality. And I have been doing this since 2008, and I just write the kind of books I want to read. And I'm happy other people like them, but basically I started to write books out of frustration.
Right. Well, I can appreciate. I can certainly appreciate that. So, so tell me, you know, we talk about shortcuts to success, and we've also heard the principle of leapfrogging and finding the shortest line between A and B, where sometimes we skip a few steps or we look for ways to just get there a lot faster. Now, why do most shortcuts to success fail, in your opinion?
Because they don't have a long-term perspective. And we human beings, especially in the 21st century, we love all kind of tricks. We love these hacks to get faster to our goals. But the problem is that most of them are very superficial. They are going to help you for a day or for a couple of days, but they have no impact on your long-term vision. This is like, I don't know, getting a hamburger made 1 minute faster, but the question
right.
is whether you should eat a hamburger or not. I mean, that's usually the question. So these kind of hacks, they can be often very misleading and very, very often counterproductive.
Let's break that down a bit, because you said something that I thought was interesting. Let me make sure I heard you right. Now, I used to work in fast food. I used to work in a burger joint. I know, kind of ironic, because these days I'm vegan. So the ironies of life. But I worked in a fast food joint for 5 years, and I'm very familiar with the concept of flipping burgers. And still remember to this day some of the techniques that we used to, shall we say, make the burgers cook a little bit faster when things got really busy, and also ways to make the burgers cook a little slower when things were really slow so we didn't waste as much product. So what you're telling me is, yeah, we can cook that burger a little bit faster, and, you know, we could, you know, turn it from 6 minutes to 5 minutes, and it was perfectly safe to eat that burger. It was still well done. It was still juicy, and it was still a good burger. But what you're saying is we should ask ourselves, should we be eating the burger? Did I hear that right?
Yes, exactly. I think it has much more impact on your success, on happiness in the long term, whether you have the right strategic vision, whether you know your goals or at least your direction, and you move in that direction, and you will make many mistakes. You will not be perfectly efficient all the time. Sometimes you will be discouraged. But if you get your direction right, if you get your vision right in the long term, and you're going to be developing your business or your life for decades, and we're talking decades and sometimes 40, 50 years, then you will eventually get it right. And this is a million times more important than flipping the burgers 1 minute earlier or 1 minute later, which is okay. It's okay, but this is not, I think, the main point of the philosophy of success and happiness.
You know, I've written about something here, John, that I think may be related to this. Is, you know, we sometimes look at our to-do lists, and I encourage people to ask the question, do you need to do it at all? Some people are looking for shortcuts. Some people are looking for how to turn 5 steps into 3 steps. And I see something on my to-do list, and my very first question is, do we need to do it at all?
That's perfectly fair. I mean, I also have a to-do list, and I use an app for the phone, like many people. But I also have a list of my long-term goals, and this list overrides everything. And very often I have to compare my to-do list of the day with my long-term goals. Many times I can say, okay, I can really strike 25% of the to-do list items because they are not linked to the main goals. And this is the problem with
right.
hacks and with little tricks. You don't keep the perspective in time. You don't keep the long-term vision. And this is absolutely crucial. It's the most important thing.
Yeah, and as I think about this some more, you've really got my mind working here. I love when the guests challenge me. This is great. I'm also reminding myself that I also use the same principle when we talk about hey, I'm the business owner. I need to outsource stuff. I need to get a team. I need to not be doing this, that, or the other. I need to hire somebody to do it. And I say, that's well and good. Now, let's ask the question, does it need to be done at all? Well, I mean, would not doing it perhaps help you towards your vision? And I think if I'm hearing you correctly, that's kind of where we're headed, and I like it if so.
Yes, indeed. And let me give you an example.
Great.
It's an example from one of my books. It's an example from history, which I think is very relevant to this conversation. And it's the story of a painter, a very famous painter from Venice, who has paintings in many museums. I will tell you the story shortly because I think it's very, very interesting. And this guy, he became extremely wealthy. His name was Canaletto. He lived in the 17th, 18th century. He became wealthy because he figured out that tourists in Venice, they wanted to buy scenes of Venice. So he started to paint in a sort of Japanese factory he created in Venice. He started to produce these paintings like cookies. He made a fortune within a few years because he developed a very, very fast way to make these paintings. And now comes the story, because at a certain point, the guy was focused on his little tricks, his productivity. He became very productive, very fast, but he lost sight of his strategy. At a certain point, he made a huge strategic mistake because he thought, well, the only thing I need to do now is to get closer to my customers. So he moved his operation from Venice to the United Kingdom, where most of his customers were based. He took his apprentices, he took his technology, his methodology, and he settled down in the UK, and he went completely bankrupt. Within 2 years, he didn't manage to sell one single painting, because he wanted to paint scenes of the UK, which British people couldn't care less. So in the end, after realizing that he made a huge mistake, he was very efficient, but he lost sight of the strategy. So in the end, Canaletto went back to Venice. He settled down again in Venice. He started his business from scratch, and he made a second fortune. But the story is that he was very efficient. He was focused on little tricks. But from the moment that he lost sight of the strategy, and it was the strategy that was making him successful, he destroyed his business.
Right. So if I heard you correctly, he was painting scenes from Venice, which are the types of things that people in the United Kingdom wanted to buy. But once he thought, oh, all my buyers in the United Kingdom, so let me just go move to the UK. So now he's surrounded by scenes in the United Kingdom, and they're saying, eh, I don't want to buy that. I see that every day. I want scenes from Venice. But since he's not in Venice, he's kind of put the expediency of being closer to his customers geographically at the expense of the strategy of being able to sell beautiful Venetian scenes. Did I get that right?
Yeah, that happens to people every day. That will happen to all of us. We get entangled in the details, and we lose sight of the main goal. We forget what makes us successful, because we want to be more efficient, more efficient, more efficient, and you see, it doesn't work. And this is the main purpose of my books, to make readers a little bit more rational by showing them many examples of people who have been successful or unsuccessful, because by reading these examples and really getting to see the principles behind, you become much more efficient when you have to make decisions. Because otherwise, we tend to get lost in the details of our daily strife, and we lose sight of the principles. And the principles, they are the same today as they were 2 centuries, 5 centuries ago.
Yeah, see, that's very good. Now, this, I think, would be a good time. And we have a lot of things to cover in our time together. This is why I'm so excited about having the opportunity to sit down and speak with you here for a little bit, is I think this would be a great time to transition into the 80-20 principle and how do we make sure it doesn't mislead us. So tell us, how does the 80-20 principle mislead us and how do we avoid that?
Well, we can be easily misled, because if you take the 80-20 principle in an extreme way, it means basically that many things are not going to get done, or they are going to barely get done at all. You can say, okay, look, these are my main customers. This is my main source of profit. I'm going to focus on this, and all the rest, I'm very sorry, but I'm not going to put resources into that. And this is very dangerous, because what makes an operation successful, a business, or I would say even the life of a person, is that all the steps, the important and the less important, they are well connected, they are consistent, and they are all made smoothly and with quality. And if you say, you take this harsh philosophy, say, look, I'm going to focus on the 80% and the 20%, I'm very sorry, they will take care of themselves. And most of the time it's very unrealistic. It's like you take a car and you say, okay, let's focus on the engine and the brakes, and the rest is really not so important. No, everything is important for the experience of the customer. So the 80-20 principle, I mean, it's a nice statistical, I would say, insight. But whatever you are doing, whether it's a business or some kind of you're involved in relationships or you want to build your network, you have to be careful because everything counts, and even if it's a small thing. So I think it's very important not to be misled by the 80-20 principles or this kind of productivity, short-term insights. Because it can destroy your business if you really imagine that you buy a car and after a couple of weeks the mirrors fall apart. I mean, you wouldn't
right.
care less about the engine, and then you get an impression that the whole car is going to fall apart. And it's not 80-20. I mean, everything has to work together.
You know, what popped into my mind, I was just thinking of this. This is going back a few years. One of my clients, do some copywriting for, we had planned an email sequence for them as part of a promotion they were doing. And there were, I believe, if I remember correctly, there were 5 emails in the sequence. And I made a note to the client, and he picked up on it, where I said, email number 2, we don't expect to sell anything from. And he came back and said, well, then why the hell are we sending it if we're not going to sell anything? That's stupid. I only want to send emails 1, 3, 4, and 5 then. But the point was being missed. Although email number 2 we didn't expect to make many or any sales from, it was part of the overall conversation that helps the other emails sell more. And I had to explain that to him, and once I did, he sort of got it. It was one of those, you know, you're the expert, do what you want to do type things. But that would be, in my mind, an example of what you just said. So we're looking at the 20%, say, for instance, it gets 80% of the results. So taking the 80-20 approach, we could say dump email number 2. But that can be misleading because without email number 2, email numbers 3, 4, and 5 might not be as effective. So that is, to me, an example of being short-sighted. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, perfectly right. And I just want to give you an example from history about people applying this kind of logic. And let me just talk for a second about a chess player, Bobby Fischer, who was a world champion in the 1970s. This was a guy who was extremely intelligent. He was, of course, a very outstanding chess player. But he was amazing in a way because he was young, he was very much fit, very much well-spoken. But at a certain point when he became famous and he won the world championship, he started to think a bit like this 80-20 thing and say, okay, look, I'm the best chess player in the world. I can do whatever I want. I have sponsors. I have publicity. I have TV shows. So I don't need to take care of the rest. And he started a small fight. At the beginning, it was a small fight with the Chess Federation, because he started to quarrel about the rules for the next World Championship. It was really a stupid discussion whether how many points you have to make. I mean, it was really a joke. But the guy said, look, I can do whatever we want because I have my business under control. I have the 80%, which is my performance. He was the best in the world. But he actually underappreciated the importance of the other 20%. He started to fight with the Chess Federation. Then he started to fight with the federal government about taxes. He left the U.S. He went to play chess in Serbia when it was an embargo by the U.S. And then he was on the list of the FBI. So eventually, within a few months, the guy destroyed his life completely because he still was, yes, his 80% was the best in the world, but he was completely mismanaging the little things. And after a couple of years, he was prosecuted, he was arrested in the airport, he was put in jail in Japan, and it was really a terrible story from a very brilliant person because he had this idea that you don't need to take care of the little details, and he made such a huge mess that in the end, he never was able to come back to the U.S. So you have to be careful with this mentality because everything is important in a business. You have to get the marketing right, you have to get the operations, you have to get the taxes right, and you have to get your staff policies right. And maybe you don't need to do everything perfectly, but everything needs to be done to an acceptable level.
Wow, I did not know that about Bobby Fischer. I had no idea that he went into that spiral. That is news to me.
Well, many people don't remember the story because you only remember when he was on the front page of Newsweek. But yeah, the guy destroyed his life. So in the end, he ended up in exile. He lived his last 13 years on an island in Iceland because they gave him asylum, and he lived there for 13 years in a small island. Basically, he spent the rest of his life reading books about history. I guess trying to catch up with the principles he never got in the first place. And it's a very sad story, but this is a mistake as a businessman you have to avoid. Don't assume that you don't need to take care of little details because they will come back to bite you.
Right. That is quite a story. And, I mean, yeah, if we're looking at a raw 80-20 approach, Bobby Fischer could just look at, hey, I'm the best chess player in the world, and I'm really good at playing chess, so I'm just going to focus on my chess game. But then he's making all kinds of money playing chess, and he doesn't have his financials in line, and the federal government comes after him because, you know what they say, there are only two things in life that are certain, death and taxes, and even after you die, you'll still pay.
Yes, indeed. And it is important not to get also too much stressed because of these productivity theories. Because
right.
if you get the direction right and you work patiently every day to build your business, there is a lot of margin for mistakes. And history shows over and over again that if you build assets for the long term, you can deal with a lot of mistakes. Even if you make huge mistakes, if you get the direction right, you will eventually solve them. And I can give you a few examples from history that show that getting the fundamental things right should be your foremost priority. Otherwise, we get lost with the constant flow of new apps, new tricks, new hacks that they may save you a few minutes here or there, but they are not going to fix your life.
Right. And, you know, I think now is a good time if we could transition. You know, we're talking about, you know, the balance between 80 and 20 and how to make sure that we don't get misled by that. And we've spoken about the balance between, you know, taking shortcuts and being efficient and why the shortcuts fail. So let's broaden this a little bit and get into the importance of leading a balanced life. Now, John, you have some very unique insights here, and I have been greatly educated by you just in the less than 30 minutes we've been together so far. Our listeners know that I'm not only the host, but I'm also a student looking for the slight edge in my business and life. So I want to hear John Vespasian's take on why it's important to lead a balanced life.
Well, first we have to define balance. Because when we say balance, most people believe that it's like an allocation, like, I don't know, 30-30-30. Or so you have to, like, work 30% of the time and then to have 30% for your family and 30% for sleep. I mean, something like this, which is mathematical.
Right.
This is not what I mean by balance. What I mean by balance, and I devoted a whole book to that, what I mean by balance is that the fundamental patterns of your life, the fundamental areas, they are consistent and they are well proportioned to your goals, which does not mean that they should be 33, 33, 33 to make 100, because, for instance, if you are putting a lot of effort trying to build a new business and you are working 12 hours per day, maybe this is the right proportion for you. The important thing is that this balance or this proportion, the important thing is that it's sustainable. It has to be consistent and it has to be sustainable. It does not mean that you must have the same allocation of time and resources as your neighbor or your friends. If you have different goals, if you have a different background, if you're dealing with different circumstances, your allocation might be different. The important thing is that you make it consistent and you make it sustainable.
That's a very interesting topic because, yeah, we, you know, we hear about this so-called work-life balance. And I say so-called for a reason, because how do you really define that? And as you said, John, some folks look for the mathematical equation. So I'm going to spend 8 hours of sleep, 8 hours of work, and 8 hours of not doing work. Now, I make the point about entrepreneurs, and I've been told so many times that I have no work-life balance, and all I do is work, and I should get a job and get a life or something like that. But here's how I look at it. Sometimes it may be Saturday night, and here I am working. But there may be those Wednesday afternoons where I just don't feel like it, and there are no deadlines on my plate, and I'm good with all my projects and my marketing and everything. So I say, you know what? It's Wednesday afternoon. I'm heading out. That's it. I'm done. That's good by me. Now let's say you and I are having this conversation here right now, and let's say that right in the middle of our conversation, something happened, I bit down on something, and my tooth broke. So my tooth breaks, and now I'm in all kinds of pain and everything else. Now, one version of work-life balance holds that, well, you got to wait till the third of your life where you're supposed to be doing self-care and try and find a dentist appointment. But no, I am the captain of my ship and the arbiter of my destiny as an entrepreneur and as the owner of my business. If my tooth breaks and I'm all of a sudden in a lot of pain, what I'm going to do immediately is I'm going to find the nearest dentist that can put me in a chair this afternoon and get it fixed. I'm not going to be waiting until the weekend and taking pain pills and all that. I'm going to fix the problem. So to me, having the ability to do that is balance. Whereas other people might look at it as, well, you work from 9 to 5 and therefore you only work 8 hours, so you're balanced. I don't see it that way.
Yes, fair enough. And we have to realize also that the balance or the proportion, the allocation of resources and time depends very much on your priorities. And let me give you an example. For most people, for instance, longevity is not a priority. I mean, they don't organize their lives or their lifestyle in a way that say, I'm going to become as older as possible. Which might be a goal, it might be a priority for some people. Say, look, otherwise you would just watch your meals, you would maybe do more exercise, you might try to live in a place with less pollution. And if this is your priority, you organize your life in this particular way, hopefully if you get everything right, you become very old, you become 80, 90, 100, who knows. But for most people, it's not the first priority. But it can be. And let me give you an example from history. There was a guy in the 17th century. His name was Thomas Parr. You might have heard the name because there is a whiskey brand called Thomas Parr, Old Thomas Parr. And this is a guy who was very old. He was, according to history, he was 150 years old. And he was living in a village in England. And the guy was living on vegetables, bread, and cheese. And that was his diet. And he's been doing this for years. Yeah. He got up very early. He went with his sheep to the mountain. And then he had his lunch and his dinner. And it was a very boring life. But the guy had a very balanced life because this was his world. This was his world, his life, his habit. But then the king of England heard about this Thomas Parr and said, oh, I want to meet this guy because maybe I can learn how to become very old. So the king invited Thomas Parr to London to come to visit, and the old Thomas Parr was delighted. So he went to London and they put him on the palace. They gave him all kind of banquets and food and drink and wine, and French champagne, and this Thomas Parr, he died within 2 days because he could not cope with the high living. He could not cope with great food. He could not cope with an irregular life. And this is why I want to emphasize that whatever you do has to be sustainable, and it has to be in line with your goals. And if your goal is to become very old, you will have very different life allocation, time allocation, than someone who wants to build a business or who wants to become a pop singer or wants to become an actor. I mean, his priorities are going to be different. His allocation of resources and time is going to be different. And his ability and his willingness to take risk is going to be different. It is not better or worse. It's just different.
Yeah, I love that phrase. It's not better or worse. It's just different, because you gave the example. And I actually heard about that guy. He was well over 100 years old. He lived out in the country. He was a shepherd, and he ate a very basic vegetarian diet. Take him out of that environment and give him the so-called finer things in life, and he just couldn't handle it because it was off his balance. Here's an example just from my own life. I recently got rid of a lot of my furniture, and when I told people I got rid of the furniture, they said, well, what happens when you have people over? Well, I don't have people over. I'm not the type that has people over. I'm the type that goes other places. That's number one. And number two, we have to look at it from the perspective of, you know, it's my space. It's the space where I live, and I'm looking for a certain amount of balance in that space. And what makes me feel better, it makes me feel more content, like I have more balance in the physical surroundings of where I live, is when there's a lot of open space. So I'm happy that there's only one-third the amount of furniture in the living room that there used to be, because I get enjoyment and I get pleasure out of the fact that it's basically a big open room now. That works for me. So that's another thing that goes back to what is the definition of balance, and that's why I knew you had a unique perspective on this, because before we talk about leading a balanced life, we have to define what balance is for ourselves.
That's perfectly fine. And I want to also underline that whatever allocation of time or resources you choose, one principle that we have to learn from history, because it's something that I really present in my books repeatedly, because it's totally counterintuitive, that whatever your goals and time allocation, you have to always keep a margin of error, margin of safety, because you are going to make mistakes. And even if you are very clever, even if you take the 80-20 principle to the limit, you will make mistakes because you will not have all the information. And whatever you do in business, in life, in relationships, in your hobbies, always keep a margin of safety, always keep some savings, always keep some area, some margin where you can make mistakes. Because if you play, as you hear every day in movies, in pop songs, in novels, you get the message continuously, yeah, just do it, go for it. If you take the philosophy, which is very simplistic, it's very dangerous. You should always keep some margin for mistakes. I can give you plenty of examples of people who follow this foolish approach. I think it's good to take risk, but it's also good to be careful. And you have to be prudent, and you have to have some insight about the future, because being foolish usually is a bad policy.
Yeah, and I have seen so many things crash and burn in the name of just do it, or just say, or shall we say, to just, you know, to leap, what have you. Now, there is a counterpoint to that, and one of my own mentors has actually just recently released a book called Just Say Yes. And one of the principles is that if you want success in life, there comes a time where you just need to jump off the cliff and sprout the wings as you go down. Now, that's well and good, but at the same time, what you also get out of his reading is you need to have the right information at your fingertips. You have to have the ability to calibrate while in flight, and you have to have the ability to be flexible and make the necessary adjustments while keeping focused on the goal. And that's how you sprout your wings as you come down. Now, that's a measured approach. That's a balanced approach, which is different from what I see out there sometimes when people just leap without having any plan, just saying, oh, the universe will take care of it. Yeah, the universe takes care of a lot of people. How many people die every day?
Yes, indeed. And let me get, since you are mentioning the wings and jumping with the wings, let me give you an example of the wings, which is a real example. This is a story of Berlinger, who lived in the 19th century. And you might have never heard the name, but he's very famous in Germany because he was the first guy who actually was able to fly with wings. And this Berlinger, who was a tailor, actually, he learned to be a tailor because he was an orphan, and he went to the Catholic Church. He got a traineeship to become a tailor. He became a tailor, but he was a very creative guy. He was always coming up with business ideas. And during the war between France and Germany, he came up with the idea of making limbs for people who were injured in the war. So he made articulated limbs so that the soldiers could actually put these limbs and actually flex their legs. But he was not making money with the business. So in the end, he came up with the idea of flying. And the idea of flying with wings is actually from the Middle Ages, because even Leonardo da Vinci designed some wings, but it's actually very difficult to do. This guy in the 19th century is the first guy who actually managed to fly, because he was a tailor. He was very good with his hands. And he built huge wings with very light materials, with light wood. He used textiles, and he very, very carefully he was able to sew the textile around the wings. So in the end, he made these wings, and he practiced for several months, jumping from roofs, jumping from house to house. So in the end, his neighbors were amazed that this guy was able to fly. And he was so sure of his business that he wanted to show the whole world that he was able to fly. So he called the king of Bavaria and the nobles, and he called everybody to come on Good Friday to see him jump from the tower of the city. It was the city of Ulm in Germany. So the guy has been practicing for months. He flied many times. So he climbed the tower. And all the people were there watching him, saying, well, he's going to crash. He said, no, I'm not going to crash. I really tested this very many times. So he jumped from the tower with his wings, ready to fly and ready to amaze everybody and to sell his idea to the army. And he crashed miserably against the river, because the guy didn't know that if you fly over a cold area, you cannot really go up with the wings. And he tried many times to fly, but he never tried over the river. So he jumped from the tower next to the river. The air was very cold, and the guy crashed, and his career was destroyed. Nobody ever paid any attention to him, because he put all his resources and all his future on one thing. And he made the mistake of going for it without really testing what he was going to do. So in the end, the first example, the real example of a guy flying, in the end he crashed and disappeared. We have to learn from the story that it's very dangerous to play everything on one card, and it's very dangerous to engage on something that is not fully tested. So always, always keep some reserves.
Wow. Yeah, that's, and see, what I love about your approach, John, is how we draw these lessons from history. Because I found an understanding in business and understanding life that looking at things that happened historically is a great place to draw inspiration and draw the lessons, because we see the trailblazers, those who made it through and those who kind of flamed out, for lack of a better phrase, and we get to see these examples that we can follow. So what I'd like to do now is, we're about 40 minutes into this thing. This time is really flying here, and you take a little bit of a contrarian view on something here, and I'd love to hear this. You warn your listeners, you warn us, that unbridled positive thinking can severely mess up your life. We always hear about how we have to be positive all the time. So tell us, how can we screw up our lives by being unbridledly positive?
Well, it is very dangerous to be positive by principle. So I'm going to be positive no matter what. This is very dangerous because it can easily push you in the wrong direction. Because if you say, okay, I'm going to become enthusiastic, I'm going to be positive, I'm going to be optimistic in any case, you might be going in the wrong direction. You might be making mistakes, very severe mistakes. You might be damaging your health. You might be damaging your finances. And if you don't get feedback from reality because you are so optimistic, you are so into your mind that you don't pay attention to the facts, you might be great. You might be doing yourself a great disservice. And this is why I present many examples in my books that it is much more important to be realistic, to be a bit cool-headed, to be accurate, to be alert. It is much more important than being just blindly optimistic, because it is great to be optimistic and to have ambitions, to have goals. This is perfectly fine, but you should never keep your eyes off the ball, because just pretending that everything is fine when it's not fine, you're just fooling yourself. You might be feeling very important. You might be feeling very, I would say, very optimistic and very positive. But it's very dangerous, because it's much better to be realistic and to discover that you need to correct some mistakes, which is always psychologically difficult. It is much more courageous to do that than to pretend that I'm positive, I'm going to make it, and you destroy your life, you destroy your finances, you destroy your health, because you have stopped paying attention to reality.
Yeah, I'm a big believer in having a clear windshield. I'm a big believer in looking for the positives when they're available. At the same time, I also have two other things that I think are very important, which is having, as you said, a realistic view of what's going on, but also, and this goes to back a little bit to balance and what I consider balance for myself, which doesn't have to be anybody else's balance but mine, is I decide when I want to gain information about certain things that may not be positive or that may not be something that's going to be all that enlightening, in the interest of being informed, in the interest of being realistic. So I maintain a balance around that. I mean, right now, you and I are sitting down on the Business Creators Radio Show. We're having this fantastic conversation. Then I got a couple client things I got to do. Then I got some things to do for my own marketing. I don't want to be distracted by the so-called news while any of that's going on. At the end of me being done with that, I'll check in and see what's going on in the world. Because again, so much of that is negative, but I don't want to ignore it either, because there could be some useful information there. But I decide when I'm going to consume it.
That's I think is a good idea, and I would like to give you as an example from one of the stories that I tell in my books, because
right.
I think that to be happy and to be successful, it is much more important to have good systems and to have resilience. I think it's much more important than to be always with a smile on your face, which sometimes might be even a bit crazy. So I want to give you an example of one of my heroes from history. And he's a guy who became very successful and very happy, I would say, without any positive thinking. And his name was Howard Carter, and he lived in the early 20th century. He was the most famous. He's the most famous archaeologist in history, because he found in Egypt, he found the tomb of Tutankhamun, who was a pharaoh from the ancient Egypt. And what is fascinating about Carter is that he spent 10 years of his life making holes in the ground in Egypt. I mean, the temperature is very, very hot. You cannot work during the summer. It's only during the winter you can work. And the guy, he spent his life in the desert making holes every 2 meters, trying to find this lost pharaoh. And what is fascinating about Carter is that everybody in the world, every professor, every professional, every Egyptologist was telling him that he was crazy. He said, Howard, you will never find anything, because everything has been already found. I mean, we're talking early 20th century. People thought that he was crazy, because it is impossible. Everything has been found. And the question is, how did Carter manage to continue for 10 years without any positive thinking? Because at that moment, first of all, there was no positive thinking. It was not invented yet. And everybody was telling him he was crazy. And the answer of the story, the answer to the question, is that Carter managed to maintain his persistence, to maintain his motivation for these 10 years of a very lonely Enterprise, he managed to keep his drive because he was very rational. He checked the sources for the pharaohs, for the ancient Egyptian writings, hieroglyphics. He learned to read ancient Egyptian, and he found the sources from different writers that they told him that the tomb of Tutankhamun have to be in that area. And he found the different sources from different areas and from different times. He was sure of his conviction. And even if the rest of the world was opposing him and telling him he was crazy, he had a rational basis for his enterprise. So in the end, he succeeded because he didn't have positive thinking, but he had the facts. And it's very important that you have the facts and you have a system for getting there. And Carter had the facts right, and he had the system, because he knew that if he made holes every 2 meters, eventually he will find it. And eventually he found it the very last week when he was running out of money. He found what he was looking for, and he became extremely famous, extremely successful, and extremely happy.
Wow. Yeah, that is quite a story of persistence there. And, yeah, I mean, if you look at even today, people are saying, well, there's really nothing else to be found. We've done all the archaeological digging, and you're not going to find any new buried treasures or anything like that, but they still keep turning up. But what we see in his case is he wasn't just tilting at windmills. He put in the diligence. He was studying ancient languages to find clues where this treasure was buried. I mean, that's not just leaping off the cliff and hoping you don't go splat. That's having a plan.
Just having a plan and having, I would say, the coolness, the peace of mind to be able to continue in the face of massive criticism. And this is something that I think marks successful entrepreneurs, because they will make mistakes anyway, but they will be able to overcome those mistakes by keeping their vision in front of them, by thinking long term, by, I would say, ignoring malevolent criticism. And this is something that Carter did very well, and I think it's one of my favorite examples in my books, because it shows you in times of loneliness, adversity, opposition, that if you have the fact right, and if you are focused on something that has a future, you should continue to remain calm, and you should continue to work, because eventually you will make it.
Yeah, and it's very important to learn to handle criticism properly. I mean, it's one thing if you have a business like a retail business or some kind of service business where you could get some negative comments on Yelp or something like that, and knowing how to respond to that. That's one thing. But when you have people randomly coming out of the blue and wanting to just tear you down, I had a case of this once, John. This was about 7 years ago, I think, is I had this person used to follow me around on LinkedIn. They wanted to think they were a competitor of mine, but the fact is, they weren't really a competitor. They just wanted to pretend like they were. And they would find things where I would comment in discussion groups and just start arguments with me. And finally, I just told this person, you know, I have not seen a single thing of merit come from you in terms of how you serve any business creator, any entrepreneur, anything. All you seem to do is follow me around just so you can attack me and start stupid arguments over the technical meaning of a word at Merriam-Webster.com. So I have nothing further to say to you. You can comment all you want, and I'm just going to keep repeating that I have nothing to say to you. And she went away. A couple years later, I found out, just for giggles, I went back to her crappy third-rate website that she thought was going to take my website down, found out that she didn't even own the domain anymore, and it was a really crappy domain anyway. And I found out that she had moved on to real estate, which is a fine profession. So, John, sometimes the empire strikes back. And so what I did is I did reach out to her, and I did ask her about investment opportunities in real estate in Chicago. And I added, because my business consulting business has been working out so great lately, I have all kinds of discretionary income. She didn't answer that.
Well, I think it's a very nice story because it happens very often that people become focused on other people. They just try to take them down, try to imitate them, and this is not the way to be successful because whatever you do, you can only compare yourself with yourself. I mean, you have your own life. You eventually, every one of us will eventually die. And the important thing is that when your day comes, you can look back and say, okay, I did my best. I think I did what I have to do. Maybe I was not as successful as I wanted to do, but I did my best. I tried my best, and then I can rest in peace. And this is the goal: to look at your life one day, to look back and say, look, I did what I have to do, and I focus on my own life. I tried to do the best, and I didn't waste time comparing myself with other people that have different backgrounds, different circumstances, different opportunities. This is a complete waste of time. And it's very unfortunate that our culture is so much based on celebrities, and people become very depressed because they compare themselves to other persons who have nothing to do with them, nothing to do with them.
Right.
And they look at these celebrities and say, oh my God, I will never be so great as X. And they become depressed, and then they get medication, and they become completely dysfunctional.
Right. And I see that. And I also see folks who become so wrapped up emotionally in things that, you know, like maybe news items or political items or something like that, that actually have nothing to do with them whatsoever, but they will literally allow it to dominate all of their thoughts and all of their life to the point where they become really, I don't even know what to say about it other than, I mean, you said yourself, unbridled positive thinking can severely mess up your life, but I would also say that unbridled negative thinking and obsessing can severely mess up your life too. Does that make sense?
That makes perfect sense. And I have, in this case, a very practical recommendation. I think most people who complain about their environment, their circumstances, and this happens very, very often, we have to look back in ancient history, and I always mention a quotation from Plato, the ancient Greek philosopher, because he got the same question from his students, from his disciples. They said, look, Plato, I'm fed up. I cannot get ahead. There are few opportunities. Everything is bad. And they hear these complaints and said, look, if you're unhappy in this city because you have no opportunities, and maybe it's true, the solution, the easy solution, the practical solution most of the time is to move physically to a place where you have better opportunities, where you're happier, where you can find something which is closer to your taste. There are many cities and many countries where you can choose to live. Don't be obsessed by the negative things in your environment, because if you're really unhappy, it's better to move and to build your life in a place which is closer to your taste. And nowadays, millions of people do that very successfully. So we should not be obsessed with problems in our environment, because it is up to us to choose our best opportunities.
You know, that's, I went through that a few years ago myself. I was born and raised in the Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania area, and lived the first 10, 15 years of my adult life there. And it got to a point where I realized I wasn't built for cold weather. I don't want to live in a place where it's overcast 3 months out of the year and I lose out on energy from the sun. The culture there is okay, I guess, but it wasn't exactly what I want to immerse myself in. And what I noticed is I was spending a lot of time traveling to places like Las Vegas, Los Angeles, San Diego, and Phoenix. And every time I traveled to one of those cities, it felt like I was going home. But then when I traveled back to the place where I lived, it felt like I was going out of town. So it occurred to me, why not just move to one of those places? I picked Las Vegas because it, you know, if you look at it on a map, it's kind of like a hub where the other three cities go out on spokes that are 5 hours out in any driving direction. And just in terms of what's available here to do, what the culture's like, what the economy's like, what the weather's like, it's just more my speed. Once I thought that through, I had no particular reason to worry about it or anything like that. You know, people did ask, well, are you sure you can move away from the place where you grew up, where your family is and everything else? That was very easy for me to do. Very easy for me to do. I think for some folks, if they're listening, they may come up with reasons why, well, I can't do that because it would take me 3 years to get my business going or find another job or sell my house and buy another house or to get my kids ready to go or something like that. And my answer to them, John, and I want to get your thoughts on this, is, well, if it's going to take you 3 years, you might as well start today, because if you wait till tomorrow, it's going to take you 3 years and one day, so get a move on.
Yes, but I also acknowledge that it's very difficult to take this kind of decisions, because if you don't know exactly what you're going to get, or you don't know your skills, you don't really know your strengths, sometimes it's very, very harsh for someone to say, okay, I'm going to move to another place. So I want to give you another piece of advice for those cases, which I present
right.
in my books. And if the option, I think the best option, when you don't know what to do, because it happens to millions of people that they have problems, they have challenges, we have challenges, and very often we don't know what to do, because if you read a personal development book, the answer is always the same. You have to be positive, you have to have a goal, you have to implement your plans. But what happens if you have no clear goal? What happens if you have no plan? What happens if you have so many problems that you don't even know where to start? And there is a
yeah.
piece of advice I got also from a chess player from the 1920s. His name was Ninsovich. And Ninsovich
yeah.
Was able to win consistently against very, very strong players. And he seemed like very passive, like a guy who never did actually anything. And when people asked
yeah.
him for his secret, I said, look, how is it possible that you can win almost all the time and you don't seem to do anything? You don't seem to take any initiative. And I said, look, this is not the way it is. What happens is that I recognize that my chess plays, my games are sometimes very, very difficult to figure out, very confusing. I don't know what to do.
Yeah.
So what did Ninsovich do? In situations where he didn't know what to do, what he did was to reinforce his strengths. He spent move after move just to get his position a little bit stronger. He became every move a bit stronger. He removed his weaknesses, so in the end he always won, because the other contenders they made mistakes and they became weaker. So if you don't know what to do in life, in your business or in your life or in your relationships or in your health, the first thing you have to do is to reinforce your position, to reinforce your strengths, to cut
yeah.
out, to stop the bleeding. And later on you can figure out whether you want to move elsewhere, you want to stay there. But first, try to reinforce your strengths, because eventually it will make it stronger, it will make you stronger, and it will make you able to choose opportunities that otherwise you will miss completely.
Absolutely. And we have 90 seconds left here. Time is really flying. So what I'd like to do is turn 30 of those seconds over to you. Tell us a little bit about your new book and where somebody can pick it up.
Well, it's very easy to find my books, my blog, my newsletter. I have a free newsletter. It's very easy to find everything. All you need to do is just go to Google or to Yahoo, whatever search engine you use. You just type my name, John Vespasian. John Vespasian, you type it on Google. You will find everything in 1 second. It's super easy to find. Just type John Vespasian.